Good evening, everyone. This is our bittersweet final session, but then we reconvene in like a couple months, so it's not not necessarily so sorrowful, but I guess it's during the 3 weeks, so maybe it should be.
Okay.
It's an accomplishment. It is, well, we'll also see. The learning today is going to be on this border of like somber and not somber, so that may also be appropriate given the circumstances. So we're talking about Tisha B'Av, but we're actually talking about a... I guess everything about Tisha B'Av is controversial, but we're going to talk about a sort of controversial facet of Tisha B'Av, which I think a lot of people feel it tends to be more of an Israeli problem than an American problem, but it's an American problem too. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you first to read source number one. Take a moment. This is the prayer of Nachum. It's a special insert to the Shmona Esrei at Mincha on Tisha B'Av. It's the only time we say it once a year, just a Mincha on Tisha B'Av. All right, so read that source for a moment. It's a few lines, and let me know if you have any questions about it, any problems that need to be addressed. This is everyone's favorite prayer, I'm sure. Okay, any questions about this tefillah? Any issues with it? Everyone's happy to say it in a couple weeks? If Mashiach doesn't come in the interim?
It definitely seems like it's... I sort of accidentally read a little bit too because I opened it to that page, but It seems like it describes... the city is like completely destroyed and just gone and like burned away when, I mean, it's not. It's still around. There are people living there. So it kind of doesn't fit properly with the way Israel is now.
That yeah.
There are Jews living there and there are people living there happily. And it's not like it's a wasteland. It's a very livable place. It's a very nice place.
Yeah, there's some strong language here along those lines. Like, we could jump to...
consumed with fire.
Right, well, to say it was consumed with fire might be one thing, but you wouldn't look at modern-day Jerusalem and say, oh yeah, this is the ruin of a city,
right,
necessarily.
Right, and it needs to be rebuilt in the future as if there's nothing left there right now.
Right. Let's jump to the middle of the second line in the English. It'll be a little bit clearer in the English. The city that grieves for the loss of its children... all right, meaning it... I don't know if you would say Jerusalem does not currently have her children dwelling in it. That has laid waste of its dwellings. I think the modern city of Jerusalem is probably bigger than the ancient city of Jerusalem ever was. Robbed of its glory. Maybe you have to define glory. That's a little ambiguous. And desolate without inhabitants, which again, doesn't seem to fit. Right, the most blatant way to put it would be to go back to the cover page and look at that picture and tell me, is that the city that's being described in source number one? And it does not seem to be. It seems to be that the prayer talks about a city that doesn't really exist, and we, when we say Jerusalem, are referring to a city that does exist, which is a very different city. So this seems to be our problem, right? We're saying words in a prayer that seem to not be true, and yet we're doubting them. So that seems to be a problem. Before we go any further, right, knowing this problem, like, what are some approaches to thinking about this issue? Like, where do we go from here?
It was true in the past tense.
Okay, so when you read those words, you're thinking this was true, right? You're thinking with Jews for... almost 2,000 years thought, which is of this city as it was described. It was, you know, largely desolate and unbuilt for, you know, 1,500, 1,800 years. So we relate to those feelings. That's like the mindset you would have in this tefillah. Okay, that's an option. Other approaches, yeah?
We're also still mourning that we're still in Gullis. Like, even though we can go back and people live there and it seems like it's back in its glory, it really isn't.
Okay, so that I think involves probably like an even more non-literal approach than the previous answer, right? When it says desolate without inhabitants, shomei mame en yoshev, we don't mean without inhabitants. We mean maybe without all of its inhabitants or all the possible inhabitants. Yeah, or maybe like it is as though there are no inhabitants because it is so awful that it is not fully redeemed in whatever sense we deem. Yeah, that's pretty non-literal, but that's a way of thinking about this text. Yeah. Other approaches to thinking about this?
I'm looking at the last line cards, too.
Yeah?
That you consumed it with fire, and with fire you will rebuild it. And mm-hmm. then, said Hashem says, I myself will be a wall of fire around it, says the Lord, and I will be in his glory with him.
Okay.
I don't know what to do with all that, but that's...
Right, so it's true that in thinking about this tefillah as a whole, so I picked one line. That's like I picked the low-hanging, you know, interpretive fruit, right? This is just the obviously false line. But there are other lines that are difficult and you want to think about and maybe think about how to relate to. But I don't think there are other lines that are so obviously, like, incongruous with my feelings or incongruous with the facts, maybe more specifically. It is true that... Sion wept bitterly and Jerusalem raised her voice. My heart grieves for those they killed, etc. Those are all true things, you know? Maybe I don't feel them immediately, but I'm trying to inspire myself to feel them. But I'm not necessarily trying to inspire myself to feel differently about the fact that Jerusalem is currently full. I don't want to necessarily think of Jerusalem as empty, and I convince myself that's the case. So, we have a couple of approaches, basically kind of like allegorizing the tefillah. Right, the tefillah doesn't literally mean what it says, or we shouldn't think of it literally. We should think of it in a slightly less literal way to make it fit. That seems to be a valid option, and one that some sources take. Source number two, for example, which I cannot promise you that this is the earliest source to ever address this question, but it's the earliest one I know of, and some secondary sources also claim this was the earliest source. This is a commentary on the Siddur called Baruch Amar or Baruch Halevi Epstein. The author of probably the most well-known book is the Torah Tamima, if anyone knows it. Same author as this book. So he deals with this question. He says, we'll read the Hebrew here. Yadua, da Torahima, Elam, Musabim, Ali, Yerushalayim. These descriptions, mourning, desolate, destroyed, apply to Yerushalayim. But we should note, Ki Acharesha, Asmana, Zeb, Yerushalayim, Benuya, Barama, Im Batei Chemed, Vehechale, Pe'er. It's a beautiful city with beautiful homes. And this is 1938. This is not the modern city, which is only infinitely nicer in terms of the quality of living that happens there and the beauty of the city. Vigam Yushevim Yudim Bahamon is fully inhabited by Jews. Or I shouldn't say fully inhabited, but inhabited by many Jews. Or Aleha. I shouldn't be able to use these mourning descriptors. But, says the Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein, okay, we're thinking of this all wrong, because there's one ingredient that in 1938 was missing. What ingredient is that? Yeah, we weren't in charge. So even though it's a very nice city, it's not really the same Jerusalem, because I'm not running the show, or we, the Jewish people, are not running the show. So he quotes the Beit Yosef, he quotes the Magen Avraham, to the effect that even a rebuilt city in Israel, if it's under foreign dominion, isn't really considered rebuilt. Because rebuilt means two things. It means it has all the buildings in it, and it means that we run those buildings, and we're in charge of it. And there are plenty of halakhic ramifications of this. In terms of tearing Kriya, for example, at least in theory, there's a halakha that when you see the ruins of a city in Israel, you're meant to tear Kriya over that city, the same way people who go to the Kotel often tear Kriya as well. There are certain brachot or certain recitations for seeing these cities. Well, even if they happen to be rebuilt, it doesn't matter if we're not running the show there. So maybe we do say tear Kriya on those. So that's the earliest approach to this question, which is basically to say, these descriptors are true because we're not in charge of the city. So even though they're not like literally in the most factual sense true, they're true in terms of our experience of the city, in terms of the broader meaning of things like rebuilt or things like inhabited. That answer was really, really great for about 10 years. You know, maybe 30 years if you want to wait till the Six-Day War. Like, it was really good for a while, and now it's not good, because now we have a state. So if you want to pin everything on the question of statehood, you can't do that anymore. You're stuck. So we need other approaches to dealing with this issue. And it becomes most pronounced, not in 1948, because in 1948 we don't have Yerushalayim, but certainly in 67. Right? If you're one of the paratroopers who conquered Yerushalayim, and you're standing there on the Kotel Plaza, and you're blowing the shofar, and you believe that Mashiach and Mamish, like, knocking on the door right now, you would have a hard time with this prayer. And many people did. And that's really starting in 67 was when you started having an even more aggressive challenge or problem with this tefillah. So broadly speaking, after 67, and that's where the rest of our learning is going to go, we have three major approaches, three major families of approaches to dealing with this tefillah. And we'll see the two extremes, and we'll see a middle approach at the end. So one extreme is to say, this tefillah is so obviously false, we just can't say it anymore. We have to rewrite it. It doesn't belong in the late 20th century when the Jewish people have reconquered Yerushalayim and are now in control and in the middle of the redemptive experience of modern Zionism and the modern state of Israel. And if it, you know, you'll say if it's true in 67, it should be more true now that, you know, the more Jewish control there is. The best advocate of this was Rav Goren. Rav Goren was the chief rabbi of the army, of the IDF, in 67. In 71, they put out an edition of the Siddur for the IDF. The fact that it was an IDF Siddur itself is, like, historically fascinating, right? At Shul, you bring your Siddur from home, you have an art scroll. You know, in Israel, you have, you know, Rina Yisrael, you have other Siddurim. No, the army puts out its own Siddur. Okay, so the army has its own Siddur. Very nice. And in his Siddur here, he completely rewrote the prayer. Well, not completely, but he modified it pretty extensively. And he justifies himself. He says, this is in the sort of halachic section that precedes the tefillah, the traditional nusach, hanusach ha-mesorati, ha-miyuchas la-rush, the traditional text which was attributed to the rush. So the historical origin of the text itself could be a whole other conversation, but it might matter when the text is established in terms of thinking about how much license we have to move it around. So we'll come back to that in a moment. The traditional text, Hamidaber al Ha'ir Habizuya Vashome Ma, that talks about the city that is disgraced and is desolate, Ha'avela mi blibaneha, that mourns its children, Vacharevami Amimonoteha, Vabizuya mi kvoda, etc., etc., that sits like a mourning barren woman who has never had children, who was swallowed up by the enemy legions. Eino holem, it does not accord with, it does not fit. Kasher Yerushalayim Mishuchreret, when Jerusalem has been freed, v'nimtzeit b'shelton Yisrael, and is under Jewish Israeli dominion, Israeli control. Lachen, therefore, bacharnu b'nusach shoneh l'tfilat Nachem, we've chosen a different text for Nachem. I'm willing to throw the old text out. It's not true. It's wrong. It doesn't fit thematically or experientially. I'm going to pick a new one. And now he's not going to completely make something up out of whole cloth. He says, "Hamivusas on Nusach b'Talmud Yerushalmi, Rav Amram Gaon, v'Harambam, based on some earlier traditional sources, v'Hashmatat Hakta'im Hanirim Kibilti Matimim Kait, while omitting some of the inappropriate lines, the lines that do not fit our reality." And he does so. In the next paragraph, he has the text, and you'll notice what words he does not include. So he says, "Nachim Hashem Elokeinu Avilei Tzion, give us comfort, the mourners at Tzion." And the mourners of Yerushalayim, and Vetair Ha'avela, the city that mourns, Hachareva, that is destroyed, Vehaharusa, that is destroyed in, you know, another word in Hebrew. But it's not completely desolate, it's not, you know, sitting, crying, completely empty, absolutely disgraced. We're in the beginning of a rebuilding. You wouldn't call Yerushalayim in 1970 completely disgraced. It wouldn't have been as nice as, you know, New York or Chicago or other more well-developed cities at the time, but it wouldn't have been that extreme. And the Givon to describe the mourning over Yerushalayim, the fact that it still is not fully redeemed, the mourning over the things that happened in the past that we're still not comforted from, but it's not as extreme in this formulation. And that was printed in the IDF Siddur. I don't know that the IDF ever, you know, mandated its use. I don't know what is commented on the IDF. I would actually be curious to ask if there are official IDF Sidurim and whether they include this text or not. My sense is not, and we'll see why in just a moment. He was even Rav Gordon, who basically says, let me throw out this traditional prayer that people have been saying for 1,500 years, was a bit of a traditionalist, meaning he's still basing himself on earlier sources, and if we wanted to, we could find the source in the Rambam and the source in the Yerushalmi and really develop where this text came from. But he's borrowing from basically traditional liturgy. Now, there are more extreme versions that completely rewrite the text. Rabbi Brody, Shlomo Brody, has a book called A Guide to the Complex, where he has these like three-page summaries of really dicey halachic, contemporary halachic issues. So a lot of the topics that we've talked about in our various shiurim, we could go back to our reference guide here, like, can mitzvah be kept in outer space? He would have a short three-page essay giving you some of the basics to that issue, or gene editing, and so on and so on, for each issue that came up. So he quotes, and he summarizes a lot of the literature on this topic as well, and he says, well, if you're not Orthodox, meaning you're not bound to tradition and to precedent in the same way as more traditional Orthodox Jews, so you could just completely rewrite the Tefila. So that's what they do. The non-Orthodox movements adopted the more comprehensive changes suggested by Professor Ephraim Orbach, who's, a scholar of medieval Rishonim. Not really a... I'm curious how much he's viewed as a rabbinic figure in the 20th century in Israel, but he wrote a text, and his text was more widely adopted. The text pleads for compassion for a Jerusalem that is being rebuilt upon its ruins, restored upon its ravages, and resettled upon its desolation. So it's not even about console the mourning Jerusalem, just not as grossly destroyed as before. It's actually a Yerushalayim that's being rebuilt. We're creating new text that does not exist anywhere in traditional Jewish liturgy, because we need to for the moment. Professor Urbach also included a reference to those who died in the Holocaust and in Israel's wars. Once you're rewriting, you might as well include whatever you like. As did an alternate version penned by Rabbi Abraham Rosenfeld, who further included a plea for vengeance and the ingathering of Jews back to Zion. Netanya's chief rabbi, David Shlush, changed the bulk of the text to refer exclusively to the lack of religious worship on the Temple Mount. Meaning, what's the real problem? We'll get to this in a moment. The real problem is that we don't have Har HaBayit. I don't care about Jerusalem. Jerusalem's very nice, but Jerusalem is already being rebuilt. The only thing I'm still mourning is that there's a mosque sitting on Har HaBayit instead of the Beit HaMikdash. So that's the thing I'm allowed to mourn, and I have to rewrite everything else and completely change it. And this represents one model. You could just erase the text, either erase it partially or erase it fully and rewrite it and present a completely new text. Or, and it's interesting that you don't really see this option thrown out, or you could just not say it at all. Meaning if you really believe that we're in a new, epoch of Jewish history and we're completely changing the game, so maybe just don't say Nachem anymore. I don't really think you see that suggestion. But this is probably the most extreme on the one hand of how far you could go in adjusting to a new reality. Okay, thoughts. Do we like this? Is this a good approach? Advantages or disadvantages of trying this?
Has anyone suggested just changing it to be past tense?
We'll see that soon. Yes. And it's a more modest kind of change. But the extreme change. We feel about completely... rewriting, reworking, erasing, editing the Tefillah.
It's an easy change, too. All you have to do is add like one sentence at the beginning that says, they used to say, colon, this prayer.
Okay, so you're both advocating for a more moderate middle approach.
It's very easy. I'm not necessarily advocating for it, but if someone wanted to make that change, just change past tense, it's very easy to put a sentence in front of it.
Okay, so let me flip it on you, because I want to try to give the best argument for this approach, right? You want to understand people at their strongest. So why would you want to not modify it slightly, but give a real full-throated, change or a complete re-editing of this text? Why is that better than a small modification?
I guess from a certain perspective, there's a reason why this feels being said, and it's because we're mourning, whatever. So they want to change the whole tone of it.
I think that's right.
I think it's the other way around, to keep the same tone. Whereas if we're mourning something that's been rebuilt, it's not as extreme as mourning something that is still destroyed.
Interesting. Okay, so two different approaches, so just to make sure I'm understanding them both, right? One option is to say, the mood of Nachem is not a mood I want in 1970. Because we're in a messianic high, we believe the Mashiach is coming, it would be inappropriate to even have the tone of mourning. So even if I could technically adjust the word so it's true, I don't care. Because I really want to rewrite the narrative. No longer are we in the period of we're so sad that we don't have Yerushalayim. We're in the period of we're so happy that Yerushalayim is in the process of being rebuilt, and we are, you know, we're disappointed that we're not further along. But we're not mourning. We're not in that deep, depressed sense that Jews were in for thousands of years when they thought about Yerushalayim.
And what Ari is saying is that the tone of the prayer is supposed to be something mourning, and we don't have that to mourn anymore. So we need to change to something else that we do still have.
Right. So if you keep a modest change, so you're going to be, even if you change it to a past tense, it's going to be like weird. You know, you're still going to be saying the was desolate Yerushalayim, and like you won't be thinking about all the really sad things that we don't have. You'll be thinking about some of the less sad things that we actually do have. So it wouldn't really resonate. Okay, so interesting. Two different ways of, I think, getting at that question of not like the technical, is it true, is it not true, but the broader, like, what theme is appropriate for our era? Are we in a Nachem, we're so sad, we feel disgraced and lost feeling? Or are we going for a different feeling that is more appropriate to our new reality? Whether a different feeling because we're focusing on different things, or a different feeling because we're focusing on different thematic motifs and emotions.
So the question is, the basic thing is, are they changing the tone for the times, or are they realizing that the time neuters the previously established tone and they need to change it to continue to have that tone?
Right, I think that's your debate internally.
Yeah, that's what
yeah I think that's your, yeah. Okay, so that represents one approach. So an advantage is it keeps really with the times. Like, tefillah is resonant, tefillah is meaningful because it hits exactly the right notes. The ones that really feel accurate. There's a big disadvantage, though. The big disadvantage of changing tefillah with the times is that sometimes times change, and they change really fast. And how often are we going to edit the tefillah to make it fit? Just to give a... Or, right, oh, there are two ways to say it. So let's start with the first. I put some sources there to reflect these ideas. Source number five is Shlomo Avinair. He's a major postdoc in the, I guess you'd call them the more like politically right-wing religious Zionist camp in Israel. He's also the author of, author's kind of a funny word. He's one of the leading figures in what they call in Israel shoot SMS, or the idea of texting your rabbi a question and getting answers. So he had a hotline. People would text him questions. He would text answers. And it makes your rabbi much more accessible. And you can get quick answers to quick questions. And, you know, there are advantages because you can communicate very quickly on the fly and not make a bad decision. Obviously, the person answering a one-line question in a text doesn't know you and doesn't know your life. And they don't know how the answer fits into the broader, you know, thing you're experiencing. But they could give you a very direct answer. So he's very prolific in this area. And they were collected in a book called Piskei Shlomo. Rav Avinair was asked, "She'im lo higia hazman l'shanot et hanusach Nachem? Is it not the appropriate time to change the text?" He says, "Ana ba levaker mishivatino ateret Yerushalayim. Come visit our yeshiva ateret Yerushalayim. Hanimseit b'lev Yerushalayim hatika, in the old city. Berova hamechunas muslami, in the Muslim quarter. V'tishtachnea al hamakom. You'll be persuaded that the language of Nachem is actually much more appropriate if you come to visit our yeshiva. If you're living in Katamon, and you're living in a beautiful high-rise, and this neighborhood is lovely, and everything feels modern and sleek and rebuilt, okay, then you want to change the text. And if you're wandering the streets of the old city, and especially, he says, in the Muslim quarter, you'll see that this really isn't the case. And it's not rebuilt in the way that he means." Now, it's a little unclear exactly what he means here. Does he mean the fact that there is still some part of Yerushalayim that is not under Jewish control itself is bizuya and shomeima and disgraceful, and that's the problem? Does he mean that the actual material conditions in the Muslim quarter are less pleasant and more desolate and less rebuilt, and so you'll still feel that theme of not being rebuilt? It's a little bit unclear. This is the disadvantage of a one-line text. We're also being a little bit snarky, which he clearly is. He's not like giving you the direct answer. He's like convincing you that your question is dumb. But you get the sense that he disagrees with the assessment of the reality. So I think the first disadvantage of changing the text to fit the reality is that different people will disagree about the reality. How rebuilt does Yerushalayim need to be in order to be rebuilt? Three quarters, is that enough? What if you get the Muslim quarter, but it's still under Muslim rule? Like, where do we fall on different political questions like that? It's very hard to have a right answer that everyone will agree to. So how do we change a text to kind of fit political, where political assessment is part of the game? So sorry, Patty.
Since there's someone that went to that yeshiva and saw it, okay, took a tour and was there. So his is for sure the statement of we shouldn't change the text because the yeshiva and its presence where it is shows that there's some reality to it still? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, he says it's not the case that we should change the text because come visit our yeshiva and you'll see that the text is still appropriate.
That's interesting.
Yeah, right? Because his assessment of the political or social reality is that the things haven't changed. So now it's a machloket between Rav Aviner and Rav Goren about whether the political situation has changed enough to justify changing the tefillah. And you don't really want to be in a position where your politics are the thing that's going to determine what tefillah you say.
Why amazing it? When we were there, trust me, what those people said to us was more, obviously not dealing with saying that come or not, but was like, look what we can still do here. We're still here. And
So I assume what he meant is not in the yeshiva, but when you wander the neighborhood around the yeshiva. I assume that's what he meant. I don't think... I never visited the yeshiva in like a proper context. I think I may have like stood on the roof there for in the context of a tour, but I don't think I was there for like a tefillah or a Shabbos or anything. Okay, so that's one disadvantage. The other disadvantage is that political geographies, even if you could all agree about them, they change over time. So the best, well, I'll give you an example and we'll read what one of my teachers, J.D. Schachter, in Torah number 6, said about this. No, let's give the example. We'll save the example for another time. Rabbi Schachter said, it's not actually so clear that things changed so dramatically in 1967. In 1967, it certainly felt clear, right? It looked like we had just won an incredible, miraculous war and are now on the cusp of a new era of Jewish history. Would you have said the same thing after the Yom Kippur War in 1973? Maybe not. However, by the second decade of the 21st century, says Rabbi Schachter in source number 6, more than 45 years after the Six-Day War, much has changed. The euphoria that had gripped much of the world Jewry in the aftermath of that miraculous event has largely dissipated and has given way to profound concerns for the very safety and security of the state. You know, there are people who ideologically believe that, you know, Mashiach is coming, but they believe it less than they believed it 50 years ago. And regarding the matter under discussion here, already in November 1978, Rabbi Goren wrote that he withdrew his new text of Nachem in the course of 11, 12 years of having composed it, and felt that after the ethical, moral, and national decline that took place in the wake of the Yom Kippur War, and in light of the preparations then being made to return parts of Eretz Yisrael to the Palestinians, again, here's where your political leanings will impact your halachic assessment, he saw no reason to change the existing form of the prayer. Jerusalem's not there yet. We thought it would be, but it hasn't shaped up. So you want to change it, and then 10 years later, you don't want to change it anymore. It makes it hard to make an argument for change, or for dramatic change, because you have to be very, very confident that your assessment of history and your assessment of politics is right. And Rav Goren himself, at least in a letter that he published in his name, seems to have made this claim. Now, just as a historical anecdote, and then I'll pause, a historical footnote is that apparently some members of Rav Goren's family deny that he changed his mind, and when they're asked about it, they think he never really withdrew his text. So, not to impugn him or his reputation, I don't know where the reality lands on that, what he personally thought, what his family thought, but even the possibility that a person could have changed their mind is already enough to give you pause when you're thinking about making a dramatic change. Yeah.
If you're already changing, then what would be the big deal about perhaps doing multiple changes rather than close together before settling on something final?
You're saying once I'm okay with the change, meaning if you think changes are awful and terrible, so then you're right, you can't get anywhere. But if you think changes are fine, so yeah, make a change once, and then if things change again in the reality, so you'll change the text again. Yeah, I think that could work. There are like practical considerations to bear in mind.
Yeah, you have to reprint.
Like if the reprint sitters, or like, you know those awkward inserts you get at like Yom HaSmut davening? Because like a lot of sitters don't have a good Yom HaSmut davening, so you get like scans of a page or like a Koran Machzor.
Yep.
It's like awkward just, you know, practically. I think another, you know, more substantive problem is if you want there to be a fixed text, like if a fixed text is a valuable outcome in Jewish davening, so you don't want that fixed text to be so fluid that it's changing every couple years. You know, and then what happens when part of the city, you know, there's an earthquake and part of the city collapses? Then you gotta go back to Bezuyah and Shomana again, and then they rebuild, and then you don't. To the extent that any fixed text is valuable, you're gonna want it to be more consistent. But I hear you, right? If you really believe in this, and lo, like, that is what Rav Gorin did. He changed it, then he changed it back. He wasn't locked in, but maybe it should give you pause. Or maybe the most charitable way to say it is maybe you should be a lot less confident about your assessment of the reality if it could change so quickly. So you might want to make a big change, but you know that within 10 years your assessment could be wrong. So you don't make big changes without having a lot more confidence that your change is right, which you'll only know in the long arc of history and not in the immediate short term. That might be a better way of answering the question.
It also creates an interesting precedent in the lack of investment in what you're saying. Because if this is something that changes every couple of years, even for very good reasons, you just, when you're saying this now, it's like, well, maybe this prayer doesn't matter so much because it's just going to change again.
Right, so it could be that any prayer that is so often changed is one that you'll just take less seriously. That gets to the broader, you know, halachic and philosophical question about why there should be a fixed text of davening at all. Why can't I just say whatever I want or whatever feels appropriate? So that would be a conversation for another time. You could put it on the list for next year. Great topic, but one we're going to leave to the side for the moment. Okay, so that's all one extreme, one side of the coin. Let's change dramatically to fit the mood, to fit the times. But it raises risks about whether your assessment of the political geography is correct, whether it's universal, and you want to hesitate maybe before going that far. A second approach is the opposite extreme. It rejects the very idea of change. And you could do that in one of two ways. You could either say, nothing has really changed, and deny the premise. You thought things have changed, or things have changed dramatically, but the right things haven't changed, or the necessary things haven't changed, and you work your way back. Or you could deny that you're allowed to change things. It's true the prayer is false. Okay, but sometimes you have a fixed obligation to say a fixed prayer, and if the prayer is false, so the prayer is false. Not a big deal. It's more important that we follow the law, which is to say this, say these words, than it is that they be true. That maybe is another way of getting there. And I would say, certainly in America, and it might even at this point in Israel be the same, there's probably close to the majority position. You know, there are not that many shuls you would go to where they've officially changed the nusach to a different nusach. Oftentimes they'll use the same one. So in America, you have Rav Soloveitchik who makes that argument. He, as for quoting those who wanted to make a change, this is Rav Soloveitchik being quoted by one of his students. Rabbeinu, our teacher, opposed these changes aggressively. Reshit, first of all, you can't change tefillah. It's locked in. It's too late. You know, Chazal had the right to establish tefillah. We don't have the right to make those changes. And moreover, we're actually wrong about what we're talking about. It's not really the case that Yerushalayim is not destroyed. Yerushalayim is destroyed. Ah, you'll look at the picture on the front page and it'll tell me it's not destroyed. You're looking at the wrong spot. You're looking at all the buildings surrounding, you know, in the background, the skyline, and that's very nice. But you should be looking at the foreground, which is the mosque on Har HaBayit, and realize that Har HaBayit isn't rebuilt, so Yerushalayim isn't rebuilt. And he makes the argument even halachically. He said, the Od Amar in the second line, Shekolz Mancha Mikdash Charuv, as long as the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed, Afra Yerushalayim Benuya of Yad Yisrael, even though Yerushalayim is rebuilt and in our hands, Mikol Makom Nechshevet Yerushalayim Gam Le'ir Chariva. The city is still formally considered a destroyed city because the thing that makes the city most precious is destroyed. Right? Lahavdil, you know, in late September 2001, you might not have said Yerushalayim, you might not have said that New York was built because the World Trade Center had just been knocked down and that was one of the most prominent buildings in the city. If the Empire State Building collapsed tomorrow, it would not be a fully built city with one thing missing. It would be very much a city in mourning and a city that was lacking. And that, you know, sort of aesthetic appreciation in New York is religiously and halakhically reflected in Yerushalayim. The Beit HaMikdash is the crown jewel of the city. As long as it's not there, I don't care that there are very nice buildings and a beautiful light rail and whatever other things are going on in Yerushalayim. The city itself is broken. And he brings some proofs from the Rambam, which we'll spare for the moment. There are a few places where the Rambam says that there's a halakha that applies to the Mikdash, and he expands it to apply to the whole city of Yerushalayim. So, sounds like he thinks that the city is really defined by that crown jewel that sits in the middle of the city. It's lacking, so we're also lacking. So he makes both of those moves that we suggested. The tshila is rigid, because it can't be changed formally. You're not allowed to. We don't have the authorization to do so. And we're actually wrong about the reality. It really is the case that the city is destroyed. Just not in the typical meaning of the word destroyed, but in a way that still really fits the word. It's not even like metaphor, you know, metaphorically reading the words. It's just saying destroyed in some sense of the term destroyed. It lacks its crown jewel. That's in America, and I think a lot of... I'd flip it, and I would actually say I'd be surprised if I heard an American Orthodox shul that adopted one of these like different nuschaot. If someone knows of one, I'd love to hear it, but I don't think it's so common. In Israel, you have this also. Rav Avadia Yosef in source number 8 makes very similar arguments. In the interest of time, I'll summarize them. It's along the same lines as Rav Soloveitchik, except he expands both categories. So he says, we can't change the text of tefillah. We're not formally allowed to, because it was established by the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, who had, you know, a huge amount of authority to establish fixed binding texts. Moreover, you're thinking of davening wrong if you think about it only in its literal meaning. But every davening also has secret, mystical meanings embedded in the text. So on what grounds could I change the text? There's a secret, mystical meaning that's bound up in that, which I'm not allowed to mess with. If I change the text, I'm going to lose out on that, you know, subliminal, below-the-surface level of meaning. And then in terms of the reality, he says also the reality is wrong. First of all, the Beit HaMikdash is not rebuilt. And the city is still full of churches, and he thinks churches are terrible because churches are monuments to Christians who for thousands of years have, you know, celebrated the spilling of Jewish blood. Go through medieval Jewish history, you will find this through the Crusades and through the Holocaust and through pogroms of various kinds. So that's still the case. And the area around the Mikdash and south of the Mikdash, the Muslim quarter, also is still not fully rebuilt. And spiritually, Yerushalayim is also on a very low level. So you want to say it's rebuilt? Well, it could be physically rebuilt, but I don't care. I care that it's spiritually desolate. Yeah, there's plenty of learning happening, and there's plenty of Chilul Shabbos happening. And there's breaches of modesty, and there are so many people being educated without Torah and mitzvot, and a million different spiritual calamities, you know, that befall the Jewish people. So he's kind of throwing everything at the wall, all the things that are still missing, and says, if you're looking at the physical city and you see a rebuilt city, your priorities are wrong. You're prioritizing the physical, you should be prioritizing the spiritual, or you should be prioritizing the rest of the physical, Har Habayit and the Mikdash and the other parts of the city that you don't see in the skyline. So this is a very substantive argument as well, similar to the Rav, except he's throwing a lot more at the wall to see what sticks. And he doesn't use the same kind of halakhic categories. The Rav is very halakhic about it. Formally, the city of Yerushalayim has less significance because there's no Mikdash. Rav Avadia says, feel it in your heart. Like, if you're a religiously sensitive person, you'll feel that the city's missing too. And I don't mean to formalize it in the way that Rav Soloveitchik does. But, you know, with these poskim, you have a million other, you know, contemporary poskim who go in this direction as well. So that was the one extreme we saw before of radical change. We have the other extreme of no change at all. So pros and cons. Do we like this? What are the advantages? What are the downsides of the no change approach?
Simplifies the Rav.
Okay, it's very. It's like, if you vote for the Rav, you're in good company. Okay, lots of people vote for the Rav.
And it's a little like what Sarah said. I mean, it's not only. I've said this prayer when I've been, and it's meaningful because it was the experience of our people. Like when you're reading Eicha, okay, you know, this is what they went through. So it actually. It's meaningful to me, not that I don't appreciate everything about what the Yerushalayim is like now, but that was, you know, experientially what it went through, and that we're still like, not, you know, We're in galut in lots of ways.
Patty likes the Rav, okay. And you added one extra note that neither of them mentioned, but is an important note also. Yeah. Maybe there's actually something very powerful about saying the same prayer that had been said for thousands of years. Right? Even though it's not really strictly accurate, but if I want to think about the sad things that happened in Jewish history, this prayer helps me get into that mindset. Because it's very easy to forget that for most of Jewish history, you couldn't take a plane to Israel. Or even a wagon. Forget a plane. You couldn't take a wagon to Israel. You couldn't get there, and if you got there, you'd be killed. By, I mean, not Dafka, everyone. Some people made it. But the idea that you could visit whenever you wanted was not an option. So it's good to be reminded that we didn't have it. Even though we do have it now, this tefillah puts us in a certain headspace. Okay.
Also simplifies a lot of things, not that.
Yeah, right. Avoiding change is good. It keeps consistency and constancy, and Judaism is unchanged, and that's wonderful also. You don't have to deal with printing a new siddur, or maybe multiple new siddurim every time someone has a new idea. There's a great stability there as well. You know, and, I mean, the substantive arguments also seem to hold. Right? Maybe there's a formal process of changing prayer that we can't follow because we don't have a Sanhedrin. Maybe there are reasons not to lose the mystical meanings of the prayer. There are good considerations here. I think one other thing I like about it is that it really draws your attention to lack, which seems to be an appropriate Tisha B'Av theme. If you tell me that I'm Tisha B'Av, you know, if you're trying to convince me that Tisha B'Av is fundamentally a day of rebuilding, like that doesn't resonate. That doesn't seem like what Tisha B'Av is about. Tisha B'Av is a day of mourning. So, you know, refocusing our reading of the tefillah on the things we're actually mourning for, not having the Beit HaMikdash, the spiritually degraded state of Israel, okay, that makes the tefillah meaningful for me. And that gets me in a certain headspace where I'm able to say the text and I still feel the mourning that I'm meant to feel. And if I change the language to be less direct, I would feel that feeling less. I think this is along the lines of what Patty was suggesting as well. There's one big downside. Like the obvious downside, which you've already been alluding to, which is, okay, it's very nice, but it's false. Like, you're still saying false things. That if I ask you to really defend, you have to start using less literal, more metaphorical, more halachic language, and less, like, real, actual language. Like, look at the city and tell me that it's destroyed. You just wouldn't be able to do that. And I don't know if I like the idea, or how much I like the idea, of prayer being false. I know that the Gemara in Yoma doesn't like it, because the Gemara in Yoma, dealing with a different issue, but a somewhat related one, deals with the formulation in the first bracha of Shemoneh Esrei of Hakel, Hagadol, Hagibor, Vahanoah. So the Gemara there says, Moshe Rabbeinu established that language. The God who is great and mighty and awesome. But there are other prayers in Tanakh that don't use those three adjectives. So Yirmiyahu says, I don't understand. The Beit HaMikdash was just destroyed. How could I possibly say that God is awesome? Where is the awe of God in this moment? So he didn't say awesome. He didn't say Nora. Daniel said, right now, all of the Jews are in exile. Well, the Jews are in exile. How could I say Gibor? Where is God's strength? These two, you know, and I shouldn't say authorities. Like, they're Nevi'im, right? Daniel maybe isn't a Navi, but Daniel's a major, you know, sagely figure in Tanakh, they both, you know, changed tefillah. And they seemingly changed tefillah, as the Gemara here concludes, because they did not want to speak falsely. It's true Moshe Rabbeinu coined those phrases, and it's true those phrases would then become obligatory as part of our Shemoneh Esrei, right? But at the time that they were davening, they didn't feel it was true. And they couldn't say a tefillah that was false. Rabbi Elazar said at the end, the reason they uprooted the ordinance instituted by Moshe was because they knew of the Holy One, blessed be He, that He is truthful and hates a lie. Therefore, they did not speak falsely. God doesn't want me to lie to Him. God wants me to tell the truth. So, if I am going to have a tefillah that involves not telling the truth, it's going to be difficult. So again, you could try reinterpreting and saying, really, this isn't, you know, really, it is applicable, and desolate means something slightly different than what it normally means, and Yerushalayim means something slightly different than what it normally means. But broadly speaking, the tefillah is still true. But, you know, but it's not, right? Like, we wouldn't be having the shiur if it was obvious that the tefillah referred to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, or the mourning over the spiritual state of the Jewish people. That's where you get a third camp. Rav Chaim David Halevi is one of the expositors of this camp. He was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. He was asked about this, and he said, "You're right. You know, someone asked, should we be changing Nachem? Bezot tzedakta, on the bottom of page 5, the English is on the top of page 6. In this, you are correct. I've also felt this. Gamani or Gashi b'Tisha B'Av Harishon acharei milchamet sheshet hayamim. The first Tisha B'Av after the six-day war, I felt, she'eneni yachul yoter lomar b'tfilati dvar me'ela. I felt I could no longer say these words." Remember, in 67, everyone felt this. This was the end. But even now, it still doesn't resonate as false. She'im b'chinat dover shkarim b'fnei Hashem. This is the quality of speaking falsely before God, what God doesn't want you to do. And he gives the best example of this phenomenon, the most poignant, reflection of this. Ki lo zubel vaj kol hashana kula uviyichu b'mei chag v'moed kol al hei v'chav chet iyar. It's not just that throughout the year, and especially in Yom HaSamu'ud, and especially in Yom Yerushalayim, shokeket Yerushalayim hamon chogeg, alafim alafim b'neha shal ha'umah, ba'im al Yerushalayim ha'chogeget. It's not enough that thousands of people come every day, and especially on Yom Yerushalayim and Yom HaSamu'ud. But even on Tisha B'Av that happens. Ela afilu b'Tisha B'Av, Yom Ha'evel Ha'le'umi, on the national day of mourning, kasher ba'im hamonei Beit Yisrael al Kotel Hamaravi, when thousands and thousands of people come to the Kotel, mutafim be'avlam al churban habayit, they're sitting there mourning, but they're there. You look at the Kotel and it's full of Jews who are davening. Like, what could be better? Yeah, it's Tisha B'Av, okay. But they're there when you see, all the kumdises that are happening at the end of Tisha B'Av there, and all the summer programs that go to the Kotel at the end of Tisha B'Av. There's a certain part of me, he says, gam az murgeshet pina mesuyemet bilvavi, bilibi, there's a certain part of my heart, ela lo yachol lachdor ha'evel. The mourning doesn't go there. The mourning can't reach that part of my heart. Zo pina shal simcha al reshit smichat kolatenu. It is the corner that is actually joyous about this redemption. And he's speaking, it's very personal, and I really love that it's such like a personal articulation. I can't feel these words, and if I can't say them, and they're not true for me, so I can't say them. I'm stuck. I can't say false things to God. Now, he doesn't talk about the other side of this, at least in this passage, though he was challenged on this, and in a later tshuva, he responded to some of his critics. But regardless, he says, I'm going to make a change, but not a big change. From this reason, I'm going to add one word, I'm going to change one word. So the word he added was Shehaita, the city that was, blank, blank, blank. This had all happened in the past. And there's a verb, the traditional version says, it sits desolate. It was changed to he yashva, it sat desolate in the past. So it changes two words in the Hebrew, which change it from present tense to past tense. And he solves all his problems. It's no longer false. Baruch Shekivanta to this version. This is a little bit of an in-between space, right? You can't say a false thing, so you have to make some change. But, and he doesn't tell you exactly why he resists the idea of radical change, again, in this passage, though in other places he deals with it more extensively, but you might suspect he's wary of being overly cavalier with the text. There's a certain value in being as traditional as possible. So you're going to make a little modest kind of modification. That's an option. If Aaron Lichtenstein is quoted in verse number 11 as making a different one, he just omits the offensive line, meaning he keeps the text. He doesn't modify it in the way that Goren or some of these other more radical changes go. He just removes the line that describes the depths of that degradation. Because those are the ones that are really obviously not true. It does not sit with ever children. Her children fill Yerushalayim. So you remove that line.
Which line is
it's there in the Hebrew. I didn't translate it. I apologize. Just in the interest of time in preparing the sources. Ha'evilami b'libanah, that mourns without her children. That's not true. The ha'charevami ma'onota, that is destroyed. Well, it's not destroyed, really. The ha'bzuyami kvoda, is it really disgraced? It's a beautiful city. V'ashomema me'in yoshev, that is desolate without inhabitants. Again, it has inhabitants. So that's the line he says, erase that line, you can say the rest of the tefillah. And these two approaches, and there are others like them with similar kinds of little tweaks, are trying to have the best of both worlds. Now, they have some of the disadvantages of both worlds also, because, thematically, it's a little bit of a different pattern to say mourned in the past versus mourned in the present. Maybe it doesn't hit the right notes of Tisha B'Av. You know, we talked about some of the advantages of a more wholesale change, but it at least addresses this issue of truth and integrity, which I think is really important in tefillah. You really shouldn't be saying things that are false. So if this is factually incorrect, that has to be changed. That happens to resonate with me. Now, so in like practical halacha, this is a like talk to your own, you know, rabbinic mentors kind of moment. Like I said, I don't think you're going to find many shuls that adopt different texts. But there are poskim, who I did not quote on this Makorot sheet, who said that we should not change the formal communal reading. But if you personally feel like you can't say the traditional text, or that it would be more resonant to pick one of the modified versions, they would license that. I'm not telling you to follow this poskim. Hands up, you know, no one is rabbinic mentors here. As far as I know, maybe I am, in which case you should probably tell me. That would be really helpful. But so that is a, you know, possibility. It's something worth consulting with people you consult with for your halakha questions. That might be a little bit more resonant. And regardless, I think it's fascinating to see different attempts to grapple with modernity. Usually you think of grappling with modernity in like new halakhic situations, new, you know, technological situations. But grappling with text and grappling with new realities is an equally important part of what it means to be Jewish now as opposed to Jewish in 1967, as opposed to being Jewish in 1945. So it's worth thinking about how we kind of grapple with change and how beholden we are to the past versus how accurate we want to be to what we think the present is and how confident we should be in those kinds of judgments. Okay, with that, Yishar Kochachem, thanks so much for coming so many times, learning with me throughout the year. I'm really looking forward to having a break, but then learning with everyone next year. Both of those things are true. So thanks so much.